Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds yes, who are people gonna rise up and get their share? People gonna rise up and take what's there.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can listen to it on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program is The Climate Changes Everything. Abrupt climate change is sudden climate change that is detectable over a human lifetime. Naomi Klein explains that we can embrace radical change ourselves, or radical changes will be visited upon our physical world. The status quo is no longer an option. And then after that, Greenpeace co-founder Rod Marinine shares his story with David Michael Swanson. Rod Marinine is one of the many co-founders of Greenpeace. In this interview, Rod talks about his early activist years before Greenpeace, establishing the now world-renowned organization fighting nuclear testing and Arctic oil drilling, and the dangers he faced as a radical activist.
Climate changes everything.
Either we allow everything to change about our physical world, because we're now on a trajectory towards 4 to 6 degrees Celsius of warming. That's catastrophic. That changes everything about our world. Or we accept that physical reality and we change the rules of economics, which actually can be changed, unlike the laws of nature.
That's Naomi Klein talking about her terrific new book, This Changes Everything. I'm your host, Francesca Rihanna. It's not often a book comes around that fundamentally changes the conversation, especially not when that conversation is about possibly the most critical issue human beings have ever faced. But that's what Naomi Klein's acclaimed new book, This Changes Everything, does. We're burning more fossil fuels now than ever before. This is on track to be the hottest year on record, in the hottest decade on record. Just as we're running out of time to save ourselves, the climate deniers have taken over the legislative arm of the U.S. government. But, says Naomi Klein, do not despair. Her important book offers an opportunity to shift the frame, to understand that the cause of our climate crisis isn't about human nature, but about a very specific economic system, deregulated capitalism, the kind that roared in on the heels of the Reagan Revolution and which has ruled under both Democrats and Republicans and spread worldwide ever since. It's at the root of our climate conundrum, but also at the root of so much more that ails us, from our crises in education and healthcare to the prison crisis and the crisis in economic inequality. And as the saying goes, crisis is just another word for opportunity. Naomi Klein says we can build the greatest popular coalition in the history of the world by connecting climate action to social justice system-wide. And the solution lies in spreading a healthier vision of society, one based on fulfilling human needs for community, democracy, and environmental stewardship. We can do it, and it's our only chance for survival. Naomi Klein's previous books are The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. She's a contributing editor for Harper's and a reporter for Rolling Stone. She also writes a regular column for The Nation and The Guardian. This Changes Everything is the 2014 winner of the prestigious Hillary Weston Writers Trust Prize for nonfiction. Well, Naomi Klein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Before we start talking about this book, This Changes Everything.
It's never now, and we've gotten to the point where we have allowed emissions to go up instead of stabilizing them or gradually reducing them, that we now, if we're going to stay within our global carbon budget, which would give us a 50-50 chance of keeping temperatures below 2 degrees warming, and that's a target that our governments have already agreed to. It's actually quite a dangerous target, 2 degrees Celsius, because we're already seeing very dangerous impacts with warming at 0.7 Celsius. So, why would we want to more than double that? But that's what we've agreed to do. And if we're serious about that, what we know is that we have to start cutting our emissions immediately by 8 to 10% a year, or else we will have waited so long that we'll have to cut so quickly that it's basically impossible, right? If you wait till the last minute, it's like, if you wait till 5 minutes before your term paper's due, you can't actually write it. It takes time, and it takes time to wean ourselves from fossil fuels. Already, talking about 8 to 10% reductions a year, is a massive challenge. It is, however, possible. But, the reason why my book is called This Changes Everything is because it isn't possible to meet those targets without changing our economic system. Our economic system is not built for that kind of deliberate strategic planning where we choose to contract parts of our economy and expand other parts of our economy, where we very forcefully regulate powerful corporations. We've been going in the opposite direction. So either we allow everything to change about our physical world, because we're now on a trajectory towards 4 to 6 degrees Celsius of warming. That's catastrophic. That changes everything about our world. Or we accept that physical reality and we change the rules of economics, which actually can be changed, unlike the laws of nature.
Right. I mean, you point out that the climate crisis happened both because of and at the same time as, the worst possible moment when we had deregulated capitalism. It doesn't sound as if you're saying that capitalism itself, in other words, that individual entrepreneurs who may establish green businesses mm-hmm. have to be done away with. We are not really talking about command and control, economic so-called communism. What exactly are you talking about? And
yeah.
Show us the pathway from the system we have now to where we can go.
Right. So, I think, when the subtitle of the book is Capitalism versus the Climate, and I think when some people hear that, it's just like, oh, okay, she's saying we need, state socialism, and, that's not going to do it either. That state socialism, industrial socialism on the Soviet model was disastrous for the environment. And, really what is at the heart of this is a mindset that sees the earth really as infinite and sees humanity's role as being able to endlessly extract without giving back. And so we need to shift from an extractivist economy to a regenerative economy. And, in terms of this challenge, it's complicated because on the one hand, if we think about this bad timing, that if we want to understand this failure, we have to look at it in the context of when this crisis hit us and this terrible case of bad timing that climate change has suffered from, in that it hit us, it landed on our laps in the late 1980s, which was the triumphant moment for deregulated capitalism. So if it had hit us in the 1970s when it was still, not a dirty word to interfere in the market and regulate corporations and to pass laws like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and so on, then maybe we would have responded to the crisis quite differently. The problem now is that we suffer from a procrastination penalty, which is a term that Michael Mann uses, the climate scientist Michael Mann at Penn State University. He's a great scientist and a great writer who wrote The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And the procrastination penalty means, when you do nothing about the problem and indeed go in the wrong direction and allow emissions to increase year after year. Global emissions have gone up by around 65% in the years since our governments have been meeting to try to solve this problem. And greenhouse gases, the problem with that is that they stay up there. This is the crux of it, is that carbon stays in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So as we have failed, we have made the problem worse. We have made our challenge challenge worse. And now it's not just a challenge to this particular post-Keynesian sort of extreme capitalism that says there's something wrong with regulation. It's actually a challenge to the core logic of growth above all else that is really at the center of our economic system. So it isn't just deregulated capitalism. I would argue that it is a challenge to capitalist logic itself, which elevates growth to the main goal of our economic system. That said, I don't think this is about abolishing markets, abolishing private property. It's about changing the mix. And certainly, private companies can be part of the solution to climate change. But we can't leave the climate crisis to the market, as our current ideology would have us do, creating market-based solutions, creating, you know, emission trading schemes, carbon offsets, all of these ways in which we've tried to reconcile market logic with a crisis that is just frankly, you know, too big for that.
You burn up all your credit on the family of kids who pop your pills and smoke your pipe. And after the war broke your piggy bank, all the bastards broke the world in time. So we sleep with our guns.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Naomi Klein about her latest book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism and the Climate.
You know, a couple of years ago, I spoke with Ralph Nader about his book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And I thought of it last spring when the Titans of Wall Street, Hank Paulson, Bob Rubin, came out with the Risky Business Report, which was really a terrific report. I mean, I read the whole thing from cover to cover. You know, they basically said that climate change was bad for business and needed to be aggressively tackled. And when I read it, I thought, oh, maybe the super rich really will save us. But you say that's unlikely.
And then you read my book and you're like, oh, I guess
not. Exactly. So give us a critique there.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is I think that there's this strange assumption sometimes that we have an economic system that is far more rational than it actually is, right? You know, I have no doubt that Frank Paulson and Michael Bloomberg, you know, and the sort of big name backers of this report, Tom Steyer, fully understand that our economic system is in danger in a future of serial disasters. I mean, these climate change costs. It costs businesses, and it most of all costs government. But we don't have a system that thinks long term. We have a system that is built to pursue that short-term boost above all else. And indeed, it often penalizes long-term thinking. And so the ultimate example that I give of this in the book is Michael Bloomberg. And Michael Bloomberg is, you know, a big-time green philanthropist. He, as I said, is one of the backers of this report. He's been one of the most outspoken of our, you know, oligarchs about climate change when he was mayor of New York City and since as he's a UN envoy on climate change. And he talks a lot about the risks to the economy, the risks to business of, you know, a future of climate chaos. At the same time, as a private investor, as an individual, as a billionaire worth upwards of $33 billion, Michael Bloomberg chooses to invest his money in a fund that was especially created for his wealth called Willett Associates that specializes in investing in oil and gas assets. So to me, what that shows is you can simultaneously understand the long-term risks, but do what our system is built to do, which is take advantage of those short-term profits that the system is still providing, and then try to get out, you know, I guess, in time. You know, Tom Steyer, who's this sort of controversial billionaire who spent a lot on climate advertising in this election cycle and has political ambitions himself, it seems, you know, he's an interesting case because he understands the climate risks, but yet he left his hedge fund because that hedge fund refused to divest from fossil fuels, because even if they understand the risks, they still want to take advantage of the profits. So it's not about whether our billionaires get it. You know, I think that's this sort of, I think we tend to overly personalize these things, right? Where it's sort of like, if I could just appeal to this, you know, very smart person like Warren Buffett and get him to see what a big problem it is and, you know, appeal to him as a grandfather, then he'll act. I believe Warren Buffett gets it, but Warren Buffett is also, you know, the owner of one of the largest coal haulers in the United States that is pushing, you know, for big coal expansion and coal exports because he's a businessman. So we have governments for a reason. You know, we have governments because they are supposed to be capable of long-term rational thinking, and we can't leave it to the market.
Yeah, and in fact, you have just a really wonderful scene in the book where you go to a conference put on by the Heartland Institute. I mean, of all Orwellian terms, I think that is one. The Heartland Institute, you know, this ultra-right-wing, climate-denying organization. And you say those guys, the Koch brothers, all of them, they get it. They know climate change is happening, but they understand the message in this book more than possibly anybody else in the ruling class. What do they understand?
It's funny, the Heartland Institute actually wrote a review of the book where they compared it to Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged for the Left, which I saw as a terrible insult, but I actually think they consider to be quite a compliment.
Really? Absolutely.
they're big Atlas Shrugged fans over there. I think that what they understand is that if the science is true, then it challenges their entire ideological mission, which is to dismantle government, liberate capital, and, you know, leave everything to the market. Climate change says, oh, hold on a minute. greed is not always good. It's at the heart of this crisis. We need to intervene. We need to act collectively. So they understand the depths of the political, the political implications of climate change, including the implications it has for addressing inequality between nations and within nations. Because if we accept that climate change is real and that humans are causing it, then we also have to admit that certain humans have done more to cause it than other humans, and that there's a fundamental injustice in the way this crisis is playing out, in that the countries that are most vulnerable to climate change are the poorest countries in the world that have emitted least. And therefore, we owe them a debt. We owe them the technology and the resources to help them cope with the impacts of climate change, and also to pull themselves out of poverty without worsening the crisis, to pull themselves out of poverty by leapfrogging over fossil fuels towards green energy, which many countries don't have the resources to do on their own. So it forces us to talk about these very thorny issues like redistribution of wealth and income inequality. And that kind of makes people at the Heartland Institute's head explode. I find that entirely understandable and predictable. You know, from their perspective, it really does seem like the end of the world. I have a lot less patience for liberal green groups that have really sort of papered over the extent to which climate change represents a profound political challenge to our dominant ideology, and have tried to sort of shoehorn this crisis into market logic by proposing, emission trading schemes and consumer-based responses and carbon offsetting and all of these so-called market-based solutions, as opposed to, more robust regulatory responses that would have been able to address this issue a long time ago.
One, two, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, flock.
5, 6, 7 o'clock, now he's a lock.
9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock.
We're going to flock around Barack tonight.
When Barack says change, supporters soar.
We'll change everything and then change some more.
Tell Barack we're in this to the hilt.
He's going to see this nation is rebuilt.
We're going to flock to Barack and pacify white guilt.
Says that he's against the war.
He's been opposed since he was four.
He's a Harvard grad with a Senate seat.
He was raised in Hawaii where life is sweet.
When you say it like that, he kinda sounds elite.
His experience is less than mine.
Who cares? Obama is so fine.
His inspiration you cannot deny.
But for the nation, is he right and why?
He will be pres, cause Oprah says that's why.
Giving in to our own slavery? Are we still working our lives away for the man who will never have to work? Beyond his office, fax, and phone. Beyond his big life built on your time and sweat, which he thinks he owns. But no, no, no. Could have sworn so long, long ago. And how many riots incited before you are shown that we don't condone this arrangement? How many lives left in ruins before we all change it? Step up for humanity, still reluctantly trudging through indentured slavery. Indentured via time clock. We show up for work and we just take our wheels off, and we just do what we're told. We're grateful for any small chunk of the American gold. Well, I say leave the gold in the ground and don't move the factories overseas, but you can still shut them down. We'll turn them all into free houses, free schools. We'll switch paying bills with the tools that we use to run it all ourselves. Thank you. for naive? And how am I for an idealist? You can critique me. It's just what they want you to think if you accept their broken world. You're just a realist. And the women are still stuck in to working the same to make less than husband, father, brother, boyfriend. And some are quoting the suffragettes. They say, come on, women died so men could represent us. So vote, vote, vote. Come on, girls, we fought for the vote. Your vote for all the good men who keep this titanic patriarchy afloat. Or you can vote for a woman who might stand a chance if she plays along, if she's got enough class. Yeah, they might let her in to be their token, be their underling. 'Cause you have the right to choose your master. Poor substitution for revolution. But hey, elections happen faster. Well, I guess I'm over it. I'm done condoning it. 'Cause I don't want representation. I'd rather hear every last voice of dissension. And I would rather know where you stand, not who I'm supposed to write to if you make me mad. How's that for naive? And how am I for an idealist? You can critique me. That's just what they want you to think if you accept their broken world. You're just a realist. You're just a realist. You're just a realist.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.